I called Julia to tell her that Ellen was coming up for a few days. Of course, I didn't reach Julia, just her voicemail. I left a longish message explaining what was happening. Then I went to do the shopping, because with Ellen staying over, we'd need some extra supplies. I was rolling my cart down the supermarket aisle when I got a call from the hospital. It was the beardless ER doctor again. He was calling to check on Amanda, and I said her bruises were almost gone.
"That's good," he said. "Glad to hear it."
I said, "What about the MRI? The doctor said the MRI results were not relevant because the machine had malfunctioned and had never examined Amanda.
"In fact, we're worried about all the readings for the last few weeks," he said, "because apparently the machine was slowly breaking down."
"How do you mean?"
"It was being corroded or something. All the memory chips were turning to powder."
I felt a chill, remembering Eric's MP3 player.
"Why would that happen?" I said.
"Well, the best guess, it's been corroded by some gas that escaped from the wall lines, probably during the night, like chlorine gas, that'd do it. Except the thing is, only the memory chips were damaged. The other chips were fine."
Things were getting stranger by the minute. And they got stranger still a few minutes later, when Julia called, all cheerful and upbeat, to announce that she was coming home in the afternoon and would be there in plenty of time for dinner.
"It'll be great to see Ellen," she said. "Why is she coming?"
"I think she just wanted to get out of town."
"Well, it'll be great for you to have her around for a few days. Some grown-up company."
"You bet," I said.
I waited for her to explain why she hadn't come home. But all she said was,
"Hey, I gotta run, Jack. I'll talk to you later."
"Julia," I said, "wait a minute."
"What?"
I hesitated, wondering how to put it. I said, "I was worried about you last night."
"You were? Why?"
"When you didn't come home."
"Honey, I called you. I got stuck out at the plant. Didn't you check your messages?"
"Yes."
"And you didn't have a message from me?"
"No, I didn't."
"Well, I don't know what happened. I left you a message, Jack. I called the house first and got Maria, but she couldn't, you know, it was too complicated. So then I called your cell, and I left you a message that I was stuck at the plant until today."
"Well, I didn't get it," I said, trying not to sound like I was pouting.
"Sorry about that, honey, but check your service. Anyway, listen, I really have to go. See you tonight, okay? Kiss, kiss."
And she hung up. I pulled my cell phone out of my pocket and checked it. There was no message. I checked the phone log. There were no calls last night. Julia hadn't called me. No one had called me. I began to feel a sinking sensation, that descent into depression again. I felt tired. I couldn't move. I stared at the produce on the supermarket shelves. I couldn't remember why I was there. I had just about decided to leave the supermarket when my cell phone rang in my hand. I flipped it open. It was Tim Bergman, the guy who had taken over my job at Mediatronics.
"Are you sitting down?" he said.
"No, why?"
"I've got some pretty strange news. Brace yourself."
"Okay."
"Don wants to call you."
Don Gross was the head of the company. The guy who had fired me.
"What for?"
"He wants to hire you back."
"He wants what?"
"Yeah, I know. It's crazy to hire you back."
"Why?"
I said. "We're having some problems with distributed systems that we've sold to customers."
"Which ones?"
"Well, Fred Prey."
"That's one of the old ones," I said.
"Who sold that?"
PredPrey was a system we designed over a year ago. Like most of our programs, it had been based on biological models. PredPrey was a goal-seeking program based on predator-prey dynamics, but it was extremely simple in its structure.
"Well, Zymos wanted something very simple," Tim said.
"You sold PredPrey to Zymos?"
"Right. Licensed, actually, with a contract to support it. That's driving us crazy."
"Why?"
It isn't working right, apparently. Goal-seeking has gone haywire. A lot of the time, the program seems to lose its goal.
I'm not surprised, I said, because we didn't specify reinforcers.
Reinforcers were program weights that sustained the goals. The reason you needed them was that since the network agents could learn, they might learn in a way that caused them to drift away from the goal. You needed a way to store the original goal so it didn't get lost. The fact was, you could easily come to think of agent programs as children. The programs forgot things, lost things, dropped things. It was all emergent behavior. It wasn't programmed, but it was the outcome of programming. And apparently, it was happening to Zymos.
Well, Tim said, Don figures you were running the team when the program was originally written, so you're the guy to fix it. Plus, your wife is high up in Zymos management, so your joining the team will reassure their top people.
I wasn't sure that was true, but I didn't say anything.
Anyway, that's the situation, Tim continued. I'm calling you to ask if Don should call you, because he doesn't want to get rejected.
I felt a burst of anger. He doesn't want to get rejected?
Tim, I said, I can't go back to work there. Oh, you wouldn't be here. You'd be up at the Zymos fab plant.
Oh, yes? How would that work?
Don would hire you as an off-site consultant, something like that.
Uh-huh, I said, in my best non-committal tone. Everything about this proposal sounded like a bad idea. The last thing I wanted to do was to go back to work for that son-of-a-bitch Don. And it was always a bad idea to return to a company after you've been fired, for any reason, under any arrangement. Everybody knew that. But on the other hand, if I agreed to work as a consultant, it would get rid of my shelf life problem, and it would get me out of the house. It would accomplish a lot of things. After a pause, I said, Listen, Tim, let me think about it.
You want to call me back?
Okay, yes.
When will you call? He said.
The tension in his voice was clear. I said, You've got some urgency about this?
Yeah, well, some. Like I said, that contract's driving us crazy. We have 5 programmers from the original team practically living out at that Zymos plant, and they're not getting anywhere on this problem, so if you're not going to help us, we have to look elsewhere right away.
Okay, I'll call you tomorrow, I said.
Tomorrow morning, he said, hinting.
Okay, I said. Yes, tomorrow morning. Tim's call should have made me feel better about things, but it didn't. I took the baby to the park and pushed her in the swing for a while. Amanda liked being pushed in the swing. She could do it for 20 or 30 minutes at a time, and always cried when I took her out. Later, I sat on the concrete curb of the sandbox while she crawled around and pulled herself up to standing on the concrete turtles and other playthings. One of the older toddlers knocked her over, but she didn't cry, she just got back up. She seemed to like being around the older kids. I watched her and thought about going back to work.
Of course you told them yes, Ellen said to me.
We were in the kitchen. She had just arrived, her black suitcase unpacked in the corner. Ellen looked exactly the same, still rail-thin, energetic, blonde, hyper. My sister never seemed to age. She was drinking a cup of tea from tea bags that she had brought with her, special organic oolong tea from a special shop in San Francisco. That hadn't changed either. Ellen had always been fussy about food, even as a kid. As an adult, she traveled around with her own teas, her own salad dressings, her own vitamins, neatly arranged in little glassine packs.
No, I didn't, I said.
I didn't tell them yes. I said I'd think about it.
Think about it? Are you kidding? Jack, you have to go back to work. You know you do.
She stared at me, appraising.
You're depressed. I'm not. You should have some of this tea, she said. All that coffee is bad for your nerves. Tea has more caffeine than coffee. Jack, you have to go back to work.
I know that, Ellen.
And if it's a consulting job, wouldn't that be perfect? Solve all your problems?
I don't know, I said.
Really? What don't you know?
I don't know if I'm getting the full story, I said.
I mean, if Zymos is having all this trouble, how come Julia hasn't said anything about it to me?
Ellen shook her head.
Well, it sounds like Julie isn't saying much of anything to you these days.
She stared at me.
So why didn't you accept right away?
I need to check around first.
Check what, Jack?
Her tone conveyed disbelief. Ellen was acting like I had a psychological problem that needed to be fixed. My sister was starting to get to me, and we'd only been together a few minutes. My older sister treating me like I was a kid again. I stood up.
Listen, Ellen, I said. I spent my life in this business, and I know how it works. There's two possible reasons Don wants me back. The first is, the company's in a jam, and they think I can help.
That's what they said.
Right, that's what they said. But the other possibility is that they've made an incredible mess of things, and by now, it can't be fixed, and they know it.
So they want somebody to blame.
Right. They want a donkey to pin the tail on. She frowned. I saw her hesitate.
Do you really think so?
I don't know. That's the point, I said. But I have to find out.
Which you will do by?
By making some calls. Maybe paying a surprise visit to the Fab building tomorrow.
Okay, that sounds right to me.
I'm glad I have your approval.
I couldn't keep the irritation out of my voice.
Jack, she said. She got up and hugged me. I'm just worried about you, that's all.
I appreciate that, I said. But you're not helping me.
Okay. Then, what can I do to help you?
Watch the kids while I make some calls. I figured I would first call Ricky Morse, the guy I'd seen in the supermarket buying Pampers. I had a long relationship with Ricky. He worked at Zymos, and he was casual enough about information that he might tell me what was really going on there. The only problem was that Ricky was based in the Valley, and he'd already told me that the action was all at the Fab building. Thought he was a place for me to start. I called his office, but the receptionist said,
I'm sorry, Mr. Morse is not in the office.
When is he expected back?
I really couldn't say. Do you want voicemail?
I left Ricky a voicemail message. Then I called his home number. His wife answered. Mary was getting her Ph.D. in French history. I imagined her studying, bouncing the baby with the book open on her lap. I said, How are you, Mary?
I'm fine, Jack.
How's the baby? Ricky tells me you never get diaper rash. I'm jealous. I tried to sound casual, just a social call. Mary laughed.
She's a good baby, and we didn't have colic, thank God. But Ricky hasn't been around for the rashes, she said. We've had some.
I said, Actually, I'm looking for Ricky. Is he there?
No, Jack, he's been gone all week. He's out at that Fab plant in Nevada.
Oh, right. I remembered now that Ricky had mentioned that when we had met in the supermarket.
Have you been out to that plant?
Mary said. I thought I detected an uneasy tone.
No, I haven't, but... Julia is there a lot, isn't she? What does she say about it?
Definitely worried.
Well, not much. I gather they have new technology that's very hush-hush.
Why?
She hesitated.
Maybe it's my imagination.
What is?
Well, sometimes when Ricky calls, he sounds kind of weird to me.
How?
I'm sure he's distracted and working hard, but he says some strange things. He He doesn't always make a lot of sense, and he seems evasive, like he's, I don't know, hiding something.
Hiding something. She gave a self-deprecating laugh.
I even thought maybe he's having an affair. You know that woman Mei Chang is out there, and he always liked her. She's so pretty.
Mei Chang used to work in my division at Mediatronics. I hadn't heard she was at the fab plant.
Yes, I think a lot of the people who used to work for you are there now.
Well, I said, I don't think Ricky is having an affair, Mary. It's just not like him. And it's not like May.
It's the quiet ones you have to watch out for, she said, apparently referring to May. And I'm still nursing, so I haven't lost my weight yet. I mean, my thighs are as big as sides of beef.
I don't think that...
They rub together when I walk, squishy.
Mary, I'm sure...
Is Julia okay, Jack? She's not acting weird?
No more than usual, I said, trying to make a joke. I was feeling bad as I said it. For days I had wished that people would level with me about Julia, but now that I had something to share with Mary, I wasn't going to level with her. I was going to keep my mouth shut. I said, Julia's working hard, and she sometimes is a little odd.
Does she say anything about a black cloud?
No.
The New World, being present for the birth of the New World Order?
That sounded like conspiracy talk to me, like those people who worried about the Trilateral Commission and thought that the Rockefellers ran the world.
No, nothing like that. She mentioned a black cloak?
I felt suddenly slowed down, moving very slowly.
What? The other night, Ricky was talking about a black cloak, being covered in a black cloak. It was late, he was tired, he was sort of babbling.
What did he say about the black cloak?
Nothing, just that.
She paused.
You think they're taking drugs out there?
I don't know, I said.
You know, there's pressure working around the clock, and nobody's sleeping much. I wonder about drugs.
Let me call Ricky, I said. Mary gave me his cell phone number, and I wrote it down. I was about to dial it when the door slammed, and I heard Eric say,
Hey, Mom, who's that guy in the car with you?
I got up and looked out the window at the driveway. Julia's BMW convertible was there, top down. I checked my watch. It was only 4:30. I went out into the hall and saw Julia hugging Eric. She was saying,
It must have been sunlight on the windshield. There's nobody else in the car.
Yes, there was. I saw him.
Oh, yes?
She opened the front door.
Go look for yourself.
Eric went out onto the lawn. Julia smiled at me.
He thinks someone was in the car.
Eric came back in, shrugging.
Oh, well, guess not.
That's right, honey.
Julia walked down the hall toward me.
Is Ellen here?
Just got here.
Great. I'm going to take a shower and we'll talk. Let's open some wine. What do you want to do about dinner?
I've got steaks ready.
Great. Sounds great.
And with a cheerful wave, she went down the hallway. It was a warm evening, and we had dinner in the backyard. I put out the red checkered tablecloth and grilled the steaks on the barbecue, wearing my chef's apron that said, The chef's word is law, and we had a sort of classic American family dinner. Julia was charming and chatty, focusing her attention on my sister, talking about the kids, about school, about changes she wanted to make on the house.
That window has to come out,
she said, pointing back at the kitchen.
And we'll put French doors in so it'll open to the outside. It'll be great.
I was astonished by Julia's performance. Even the kids were staring at her. Julia mentioned how proud she was of Nicole's big part in the forthcoming school play. Nicole said,
Mom,
I have a bad part. Oh, not really, honey,
Julia said.
Yes, I do. I just have two lines. Now, honey, I'm sure you're...
Eric piped up.
Look, here comes John now. That sounds pretty serious. Shut up, weasel turd. She says it in the bathroom over and over,
Eric announced.
About a billion gazillion times,
Julia said.
Who's John? Those are the lines in the play. Oh, well, anyway, I'm sure you'll be wonderful. And our little Eric is making such progress in soccer, aren't you, hon?
It's over next week, Eric said, turning sulky. Julia hadn't made it to any of his games this fall.
It's been so good for him,
Julia said to Ellen.
Team sports build cooperation, especially with boys. It helps with that competitiveness.
Ellen wasn't saying anything, just nodding and listening. For this particular evening, Julia had insisted on feeding the baby and had positioned the high chair beside her. But Amanda was accustomed to playing airplane at every mealtime. She was waiting for someone to move the spoon toward her, saying, "Wow, here comes the airplane. Open the doors." And since Julia wasn't doing that, Amanda kept her mouth tightly shut, which was part of the game, too.
"Oh, well, I guess she's not hungry,"
Julia said with a shrug.
"Did she just have a bottle, Jack?"
"No," I said. "She doesn't get one until after dinner."
"Well, I know that. I meant before."
"No," I said. "Not before." I gestured toward Amanda. "Shall I try?"
"Sure."
Julia handed me the spoon, and I sat beside Amanda and began to play airplane. "Wow." Amanda immediately grinned and opened her mouth.
"Jack's been wonderful with the kids, just wonderful,"
Julia said to Ellen.
"I think it's good for a man to experience home life," Ellen said. "Oh, it is. It is. He's helped me a lot."
She patted my knee.
"You really have, Jack."
It was clear to me that Julia was too bright, too cheerful. She was keyed up, talking fast, and obviously trying to impress Ellen that she was in charge of her family. I could see that Ellen wasn't buying it, but Julia was so speedy she didn't notice. I began to wonder if she were on drugs. Was that the reason for her strange behavior? Was she on amphetamines?
"And work,"
Julia continued,
"is so incredible these days. Zymos is really making breakthroughs, the kind of breakthroughs people have been waiting for more than 10 years to happen, but at last it's happening."
"Like the black cloak?" I said, fishing. Julia blinked.
"The what?"
She shook her head.
"What are you talking about, hon?"
"A black cloak. Didn't you say something about a black cloak the other day?"
"No."
She shook her head.
"I don't know what you mean."
She turned back to Ellen.
"Anyway, all this molecular technology has been much slower to come to market than we expected, but at last, it really is here."
"You seem very excited," Ellen said.
"I have to tell you, it's thrilling, Ellen."
She lowered her voice.
"And on top of it, we'll probably make a bundle."
"That'd be good," Ellen said.
"But I guess you've had to put in long hours." "Not that long,"
Julia said.
"All things considered, it hasn't been bad, just the last week or so."
I saw Nicole's eyes widen. Eric was staring at his mother as he ate. But the kids didn't say anything, neither did I.
"It's just a transition period,"
Julia continued.
"All companies have these transitional periods."
"Of course," Ellen said. The sun was going down. The air was cooler. The kids left the table. I got up and started to clear. Ellen was helping me. Julia kept talking, then said,
"I'd love to stay, but I have something going on, and I have to get back to the office for a while."
If Ellen was surprised to hear this, she didn't show it. All she said was,
"Long hours." "Just during this transition."
She turned to me.
"Thanks for holding the fort, honey."
At the door, she turned, blew me an air kiss.
"Love, Jack."
And she left. Ellen frowned, watching her go. Just a little abrupt, wouldn't you say? I shrugged.
Will she say goodbye to the kids?
Probably not.
She'll just run right out the door?
Right. Ellen shook her head.
Jack, she said, I don't know if she's having an affair or not, but what's she taking?
Nothing, as far as I know.
She's on something, I'm certain of it. Would you say she's lost weight?
Yes, some.
And sleeping very little, and obviously speedy.
Ellen shook her head.
A lot of these hard-charging executives are on drugs.
I don't know, I said. She just looked at me. I went back into my office to call Ricky, and from the office window I saw Julia backing her car down the driveway. I went to wave to her, but she was looking over her shoulder as she backed away. In the evening light, I saw golden reflections on the windshield, streaking from the trees above. She had almost reached the street when I thought I saw someone sitting in the passenger seat beside her. It looked like a man. I couldn't see his features clearly through the windshield, with the car moving down the drive. When Julia backed onto the street, her body blocked my view of the passenger, but it seemed as if Julia was talking to him animatedly. Then she put the car in gear and leaned back in her seat, and for a moment I had a brief, clear look. The man was backlit, his face in shadow, and he must have been looking directly at her because I still couldn't make out any features. But from the way he was slouching, I had the impression of someone young, maybe in his 20s, though I honestly couldn't be sure. It was just a glimpse. Then the BMW accelerated and she drove off down the street. I thought, the hell with this. I ran outside and down the driveway. I reached the street just as Julia came to the stop sign at the end of the block, her brake lights flaring. She was probably 50 yards away, the street illuminated in low, slanting yellow light. It looked as if she was alone in the car, but I really couldn't see well. I felt a moment of relief and of foolishness. There I was, standing in the street for no good reason. My mind was playing tricks on me. There was nobody in the car. Then, as Julia made the right turn, the guy popped up again, like he had been bent over, getting something from the glove compartment. And then the car was gone. And in an instant, all my distress came flooding back, like a hot pain that spread across my chest and body. I felt short of breath and a little dizzy. There was somebody in the car. I trudged back up the driveway, feeling churning emotions, not sure what to do next.
You're not sure what to do next? Ellen said.
We were doing the pots and pans at the sink, the things that didn't go in the dishwasher. Ellen was drying while I scrubbed.
You pick up the phone and call her.
She's in the car.
She has a car phone. Call her.
Uh-huh, I said. So, how do I put it? Hey, Julia, who's the guy in the car with you? I shook my head. That's going to be a tough conversation.
Maybe so.
That'll be a divorce for sure. She just stared at me.
You don't want a divorce, do you?
Hell no. I want to keep my family together.
That may not be possible, Jack.
It may not be your decision to make. None of this makes any sense, I said. I mean, the guy in the car, he was like a kid, somebody young.
So?
That's not Julia's style.
Oh?
Ellen's eyebrows went up.
He was probably in his 20s or early 30s, and anyway, are you so sure about Julia's style?
Well, I've lived with her for 13 years. She set down one of the pots with a bang.
Jack, I understand that all this must be hard to accept.
It is, it is. In my mind, I kept replaying the car backing down the driveway over and over. I was thinking that there was something strange about the other person in the car, something odd in his appearance. In my mind, I kept trying to see his face, But I never could. The features were blurred by the windshield, by the light shifting as she backed down the drive. I couldn't see the eyes, or the cheekbones, or the mouth. In my memory, the whole face was dark and indistinct. I tried to explain that to her.
It's not surprising.
No?
No, it's called denial.
Look, Jack, the fact is, you have the evidence right in front of your eyes.
You've seen it, Jack. Don't you think it's time you believed it?
I knew she was right.
Yes, I said.
It's time. The phone was ringing. My hands were up to the elbows in soap suds. I asked Ellen to get it, but one of the kids had already picked it up. I finished scrubbing the barbecue grill, handed it to Ellen to dry.
Jack,
Ellen said,
you have to start seeing things as they really are and not as you want them to be.
You're right, I said. I'll call her. At that moment, Nicole came into the kitchen looking pale.
Dad, it's the police. They want to talk to you.
Day 5, 9:10 p.m. Julia's convertible had gone off the road about 5 miles from the house. It had plunged 50 feet down a steep ravine, cutting a track through the sage and juniper bushes. Then it must have rolled, because now it lay in an angle, wheels facing upward. I could see only the underside of the car. The sun was almost down and the ravine was dark. The 3 rescue ambulances on the road had their red lights flashing, and the rescue crews were already rappelling down on ropes. As I watched, portable floodlights were set up, bathing the wreck in a harsh blue glow. I heard the crackle of radios all around. I stood up on the road with a motorcycle police officer. I had already asked to go down there and was told I couldn't. I had to stay on the road. When I heard the radios, I said, "Is she hurt? Is my wife hurt?" "We'll know in a minute." He was calm. "What about the other guy?" "Just a minute," he said. He had a headset in his helmet because he just started talking in a low voice. It sounded like a lot of code words. I heard, "Update a 402 for 739 here." I stood at the edge and looked down, trying to see. By now there were workers all around the car and several hidden behind the upturned frame. A long time seemed to pass. The cop said, "Your wife is unconscious, but she was wearing her seatbelt and stayed in the car. They think she's all right. Vital signs are stable. They say no spinal injuries, but she sounds like she broke her arm."
"But she's all right."
"They think so."
Another pause while he listened. I heard him say,
"I have a husband here, so let's 8-7.
When he turned back to me, he said,
"Yes, she's coming around. She'll have to be checked for internal bleeding at the hospital, and she's got a broken arm. But they say she's all right. They're getting her on a stretcher now."
"Thank God," I said. The policeman nodded. "This is a bad piece of road."
"This has happened before?"
He nodded.
"Every few months, not usually so lucky."
I flipped open my cell phone and called Ellen, told her to explain to the kids there was nothing to worry about, that Mom was going to be okay.
"Especially Nicole," I said.
"I'll take care of it,"
Ellen promised me. I flipped the phone shut and turned back to the cop.
"What about the other guy?"
I said.
"Well, she's alone in the car."
"No," I said. "There was another guy with her." He spoke on his headset, then turned back to me.
"Well, they say no. There's no sign of anyone else."
"Maybe he was thrown," I said.
"They're asking your wife now."
He listened a moment.
"She says she was alone."
"You're kidding," I said. He looked at me, shrugged.
"That's what she says."
In the flashing red lights of the ambulances, I couldn't read his expression, but his tone implied, "Another guy who doesn't know his own wife." I turned away, looked over the edge of the road. One of the rescue vehicles had extended a steel arm with a winch that hung over the ravine. A cable was being lowered. I saw the workers struggling for footing against the steep slope as they attached a stretcher to the winch. I couldn't see Julia clearly on the stretcher. She was strapped down, covered in a silver space blanket. She started to rise, passing through the cone of blue light, then into darkness. The cop said, "They're asking about drugs and medicines. Is your wife taking any drugs or medicines?" "Not that I know of." "How about alcohol? Is she drinking?" "Wine at dinner, one or two glasses." The cop turned away and spoke again quietly in the darkness. After a pause, I heard him say, "That's affirmative." The stretcher twisted slowly as it rose into the air. One of the workers halfway up the slope reached out to steady it. The stretcher continued upward. I still couldn't see Julia clearly until it reached the level of the road and the rescue workers swung it around and unclipped it from the line. She was swollen. Her left cheekbone was purple, and the forehead above her left eye was purple as well. She must have hit her head pretty hard. She was breathing shallowly. I moved alongside the stretcher. She saw me and said, "Jack," and tried to smile. "Just take it easy," I said. She gave a little cough.
"Jack, it was an accident."
The medics were maneuvering around the motorcycle. I had to watch where I was going. "Of course it was."
"It's not what you think, Jack."
I said, "What is, Julia?" She seemed to be delirious. Her voice seemed to drift in and out.
"I know what you're thinking."
Her hand gripped my arm.
"Promise me you won't get involved in this, Jack."
I didn't say anything. I just walked with her. She squeezed me harder.
"Promise me you'll stay out of it."
"I promise," I said. She relaxed then, dropping my arm.
"This doesn't involve our family. The kids will be fine. You'll be fine. Just stay out, okay?"
"Okay," I said, just wanting to mollify her.
"Jack?"
"Yes, honey, I'm here." By now we were approaching the nearest ambulance. The doors swung open. One of the rescue team said, "You related to her?" "I'm her husband." "You want to come?" "Yes." "Hop in." I got into the ambulance first. Then they slid the stretcher in. One of the rescue team got in and slammed the doors shut. We started down the road, siren moaning. I was immediately moved aside by the two paramedics working on her. One was recording notes on a handheld device, and the other was starting a second IV in her other arm. They were worried about her blood pressure, which was dropping. That was a great cause for concern. During all this, I couldn't really see Julia, but I heard her murmuring. I tried to move forward, but the medics pushed me back. "Let us work, sir. Your wife's got injuries. We have to work." For the rest of the way, I sat in a little jump seat and gripped a wall handle as the ambulance careened around curves. By now, Julia was clearly delirious, babbling nonsense. I heard something about the black clouds that were not black anymore. And then she shifted into a kind of lecture, talking about adolescent rebellion. She mentioned Amanda by name and Eric, asking if they were all right. She seemed agitated. The medics kept trying to reassure her, and finally she lapsed into repeating,
"I didn't do anything wrong. I didn't mean to do anything wrong,"
as the ambulance sped through the night. Listening to her, I couldn't help but worry. The examination suggested Julia's injuries might be more extensive than they first thought. There was a lot to rule out: possible pelvic fracture, possible hematoma, possible fracture of a cervical vertebrae, left arm broken in two places and might need to be pinned. The doctor seemed most worried about her pelvis. They were handling her much more gingerly when they put her into intensive care. But Julia was conscious, catching my eye and smiling at me from time to time, until she fell asleep. The doctor said there was nothing for me to do. They would wake her up every half hour during the night. They said that she would be in the hospital at least 3 days, probably a week. They told me to get some rest. I left the hospital a little before midnight.
I took a taxi back to the crash site to pick up my car. It was a cold night. The police cars and rescue ambulances were gone. In their place was a big flatbed tow truck, which was winching Julia's car up the hill. A skinny guy smoking a cigarette was running the winch.
"Nothing to see," he said to me. "Everybody's gone to the hospital."
I said it was my wife's car.
"Can't drive it,"
he said. He asked me for my insurance card. I got it out of my wallet and handed it to him. He said,
"I heard your wife's okay."
"So far."
"You're a lucky guy."
He jerked his thumb, pointing across the road.
"Are they with you?"
Across the street, a small white van was parked. The sides were bare, with no markings or company logo. But low in the front door, I saw a serial number in black. And underneath, it said, SSVT unit. I said, "No, they're not with me."
"Been here an hour," he said. "Just sitting there."
I couldn't see anyone inside the van. The front windows were dark. I started across the street toward them. I heard the faint crackle of a radio. When I was about 10 feet away, the lights came on, the engine started, and the van roared past me and drove down the highway. As it passed, I had a glimpse of the driver. He was wearing a shiny suit of some kind, like silvery plastic, and a tight hood of the same material. I thought, I saw some funny silver apparatus hanging around his neck. It looked like a gas mask, except it was silver, but I wasn't sure. As the car drove away, I noticed the rear bumper had two green stickers, each with a big X. That was the Zymos logo. But it was the license plate that really caught my eye. It was a Nevada plate. That van had come from the fabrication plant out in the desert. I frowned. It was time for me to visit the fab plant, I thought. I pulled out my cell phone and dialed Tim Bergman. I told him I had reconsidered his offer and I would take the consulting job after all.
"That's great," Tim said. "Don will be very happy."
"Great," I said. "How soon can I start?" Desert. Day 6, 7:12 a.m. With the vibration of the helicopter, I must have dozed off for a few minutes. I awoke and yawned, hearing voices in my headphones. They were all men speaking.
"Well, what exactly is the problem?"
A growling voice.
"Apparently the plant released some material into the environment. It was an accident. Now several dead animals have been found out in the desert in the vicinity of the plant."
A reasonable, organized voice.
"Who found them?"
"A couple of nosy environmentalists. They ignored the keep-out signs, snooped around the plant. They've complained to the company and are demanding to inspect the plant."
"Which we can't allow."
"No, no." "How do we handle this?" said a timid voice.
"I say we minimize the amount of contamination released and give data that show no untoward consequences possible."
Organized voice.
"Hell, I wouldn't play it that way," said growling voice. "We're better off flatly denying it. Nothing was released. I mean, what's the evidence anything was released?"
"Well, the dead animals, a coyote, some desert rats, maybe a few birds."
"Hell, animals die in nature all the time. I mean, remember the business about those slashed cows? It was supposed to be aliens from UFOs that were slashing the cows. Finally turned out the cows were dying of natural causes, and it was decomposing gas in the carcasses that split them open. Remember that?"
"Vaguely."
Timid voice. "I'm not sure we can just deny."
"Fuck yes, deny.
Aren't there pictures? I think the environmentalists took pictures."
"Well, who cares? What will the pictures show, a dead coyote? Nobody is going to get worked up about a dead coyote, trust me. Pilot, pilot, where the fuck are we?"
I opened my eyes. I was sitting in the front of the helicopter alongside the pilot. The helicopter was flying east into the glare of low morning sun. Beneath my feet, I saw mostly flat terrain with low clumps of cactus, juniper, and the occasional scraggly Joshua tree. The pilot was flying alongside the power line towers that marched in single file across the desert, a steel army with outstretched arms. The towers cast long shadows in the morning light. A heavy-set man leaned forward from the back seat. He was wearing a suit and tie.
"Pilot, are we there yet?"
"We just crossed the Nevada line another 10 minutes." The heavy-set man grunted and sat back. I'd met him when we took off, but I couldn't remember his name now. I glanced back at the three men, all in suits and ties, who were traveling with me. They were all PR consultants, hired by Zymos. I could match their appearance to their voices. A slender, nervous man twisting his hands, then a middle-aged man with a briefcase on his lap, and a heavy-set man, older and growly, obviously in charge.
Why the hell did they put it in Nevada, anyway?
Fewer regulations, easier inspections. These days, California is sticky about new industry. There was going to be a year's delay just for environmental impact statements and a far more difficult permitting process, so they came here. Growly looked out the window at the desert.
"What a shithole," he said. "I don't give a fuck what goes on out here. It's not a problem."
He turned to me.
"What do you do?"
"I'm a computer programmer."
"You covered by an NDA?
He meant, did I have a non-disclosure agreement that would prevent me from discussing what I had just heard?
"Yes," I said. "You coming out to work at the plant?"
"To consult," I said. "Yes."
"Consulting's the way to go,"
he said, nodding as if I were an ally.
"No responsibility, no liability. Just give your opinion and watch them not take it."
With a crackle, the pilot's voice broke in over the headsets.
"Zymos Molecular Manufacturing is dead ahead," he said. "You can just see it now."
20 miles in front of us, I saw an isolated cluster of low buildings silhouetted on the horizon. The PR people in the back all leaned forward.
"Is that it?" said Growley. "That's all it is?"
"It's bigger than it looks from here," the pilot said. As the helicopter came closer, I could see that the buildings were interlocked, featureless concrete blocks, all whitewashed. The PR people were so pleased, they almost burst into applause.
"Hey, it's beautiful. Looks like a fucking hospital."
"Great architecture."
"It'll photograph great,"
I said. "Why will it photograph great?"
"Because it has no projections," the man with the briefcase said.
"No antennas, no spikes, no things poking up. People are afraid of spikes and antennas. There are studies, but a building that's plain and square like this, and white, perfect color choice, associations, divergental, hospital cure, pure, a building like this, they don't care."
"Those environmentalists are fucked," said Growley with satisfaction. "They do medical research here, right?"
"Not exactly."
"They will when I get through, trust me. Medical research is the way to go on this."
The pilot pointed out the different buildings as he circled them. "That first concrete block, that's power. Walkway to that low building, that's the residences. Next door, fab support, labs, whatever. And then the square windowless three-story one, that's the main fab building. They tell me it's a shell. It's got another building inside it. Then over to the right, that low, flat shed, that's external storage and parking. Cars have to be under shade here or the dashboards buckle. Get a first-degree burn if you touch your steering wheel." I said, "And they have residences?" The pilot nodded.
"Yeah, have to. Nearest motel is 161 miles over near Reno." "So how many people live in this facility?" Growley said.
"They can take 12, the pilot said.
But they've generally got about 5 to 8. Doesn't take a lot to run the place. It's all automated, from what I hear.
What else do you hear?
Not very damn much, the pilot said. They're closed-mouthed about this place. I've never even been inside.
Good, said Crowley. Let's make sure they keep it that way.
The pilot turned the stick in his hand. The helicopter banked and started down. I opened the plastic door in the bubble cockpit and started to get out. It was like stepping into an oven. The blast of heat made me gasp.
This is nothing, the pilot shouted over the whir of the blades. This is almost winter. Can't be more than 105.
Great, I said, inhaling hot air. I reached in the back for my overnight bag and my laptop. I'd stowed it under the seat of the timid man.
I have to take a piss, said Crowley, releasing his seatbelt.
Dave, said the man with the briefcase in a warning tone.
Fuck, it's just for a minute.
Dave, an embarrassed glance toward me, then lowering his voice. They said, we don't get out of the helicopter, remember?
Oh, hell, I can't wait another hour. Anyway, what's the difference?
He gestured toward the surrounding desert.
There's nothing to fuck out here for 1,000,000 miles.
But, Dave...
You guys give me a pain. I'm going to pee, damn it.
He hefted his bulk up and moved toward the door. I didn't hear the rest of the conversation because by then I had taken off my earphones. Crowley was clambering out. I grabbed my bags, turned, and moved away, crouched beneath the blades. They cast a flickering shadow on the pad. I came to the edge of the pad where the concrete ended abruptly in a dirt path that threaded among the clumps of chola cactus toward the blocky white power building 50 yards away. There was no one to greet me. In fact, no one in sight at all. Looking back, I saw Crowley zip up his trousers and climb back into the helicopter. The pilot pulled the door shut and lifted off, waving to me as he rose into the air. I waved back, then ducked away from the swirl of spitting sand. The helicopter circled once and headed west. The sound faded. The desert was silent, except for the hum of the electrical power lines a few 100 yards away. The wind ruffled my shirt, flapped my trouser legs. I turned in a slow circle, wondering what to do now, and thinking about the words of the PR guy. They said we don't get out of the helicopter, remember?
Hey! Hey, you!
I looked back. A door had cracked open in the white power block. A man's head stuck out. He shouted,
Are you Jack Foreman?
Yes, I said.
Well, what the hell are you waiting for? An engraved invitation? Get inside, for Christ's sake!
And he slammed the door shut again. That was my welcome to the Zymos fabrication facility. Lugging my bags, I trudged down the dirt path toward the door. Things never turn out the way you expect. I stepped into a small room with dark gray walls on 3 sides. The walls were some smooth material like formica. It took my eyes a moment to adjust to the relative darkness. Then I saw that the 4th wall directly ahead of me was entirely glass, leading to a small compartment and a 2nd glass wall. The glass walls were fitted with folding steel arms, ending in metal pressure pads. It looked a little bit like what you'd expect to see in a bank vault. Beyond the 2nd glass wall, I could see a burly man in blue trousers and a blue work shirt with the Zymos logo on the pocket. He was clearly the plant maintenance engineer. He gestured to me.
It's an airlock. Door's automatic. Walk forward.
I did, and the nearest glass door hissed open. A red light came on. In the compartment ahead, I saw grillwork on the floor, ceiling, and both walls. I hesitated.
Looks like a fucking toaster, don't it?
The man said, grinning. He had some teeth missing.
But don't worry. It'll just blow you a little. Come ahead.
I stepped into the glass compartment and set my bag on the ground.
"No, pick the bag up."
I picked it up again. Immediately, the glass door behind me hissed shut, the steel arms unfolding smoothly. The pressure pad sealed with a thunk. I felt a slight discomfort in my ears as the airlock pressurized. The man in blue said,
"You might want to close your eyes."
I closed my eyes and immediately felt chilling spray strike my face and body from all sides. My clothes were soaked. I smelled a stinging odor like acetone or nail polish remover. I began to shiver. The liquid was really cold. The first blast of air came from above my head, a roar that quickly built to hurricane intensity. I stiffened my body to steady myself. My clothes flapped and pressed flat against my body. The wind increased, threatening to tear the bag from my hand. Then the air stopped for a moment, and a second blast came upward from the floor. It was disorienting, but it only lasted a few moments. Then, with a whoosh, the vacuum pumps kicked in, and I felt a slight ache in my ears as the pressure dropped, like an airplane descending. Then silence. A voice said,
"That's it. Come ahead."
I opened my eyes. The liquid they'd sprayed on me had evaporated. My clothes were dry. The doors hissed open before me. I stepped out, and the man in blue looked at me quizzically.
"Feel okay?"
"Yeah, I think so."
"No itching?"
"No."
"Good. We had a few people who were allergic to this stuff, but we've got to do this routine for the clean rooms."
I nodded. It was obviously a procedure to remove dust and other contaminants. The dousing fluid was highly volatile, evaporating at room temperature, drawing off microparticles on my body and clothes. The air jets and vacuum completed the scrub. The procedure would remove any loose particles on my body and suck them away.
"I'm Vince Reynolds," the man said, but he didn't hold out his hand. "You call me Vince, and you're Jack?"
I said I was.
"Okay, Jack," he said. "They're waiting for you, so let's get started. We got to take precautions because this is an HMF, that's high magnetic field environment, greater than 33 Tesla, so..."
He picked up a cardboard box.
"Better lose your watch."
I put the watch in the box.
"And the belt."
I took my belt off, put it in the box.
"Any other jewelry, bracelet, necklace, piercings, decorative pins or medals, medic alert?"
"No."
"How about metal inside your body? Old injury, bullets, shrapnel?"
"No."
"Any pins for broken arms or legs, hip or knee replacement?"
"No."
"Artificial valves, artificial cartilage, vascular pumps or implants?"
I said I didn't have any of those things.
"Well, you're still young," he said. "Now, how about in your bag?"
He made me take everything out and spread it on a table so he could rummage through it. I had plenty of metal in there. Another belt with a metal buckle, nail clippers, a can of shaving cream, razor and blades, a pocket knife, blue jeans with metal rivets. He took the knife and the belt, but left the rest.
"You can put your stuff back in the bag," he said. "Now, here's the deal. Your bag goes to the residence building, but no farther, okay? There's an alarm at the residence door if you try to take any metal past there, but do me a favor and don't set it off, okay? Because it shuts down the magnets as a safety procedure, and it takes about 2 minutes to start them up again. Pisses the techs off, especially if they're fabbing at the time. Ruins all their hard work."
I said I would try to remember.
"The rest of your stuff stays right here."
He nodded to the wall behind me. I saw a dozen small safes, each with an electronic keypad.
"You set the combination and lock it up yourself."
He turned aside so I could do that. "I won't need a watch?" He shook his head.
"We'll get you a watch."
"And what about a belt?"
"We'll get you a belt."
"And my laptop?" I said.
"It goes in the safe," he said. "Unless you want to scrub your hard drive with the magnetic field."
I put the laptop in with the rest of my stuff and locked the door. I felt strangely stripped, like a man entering prison. "You don't want my shoelaces, too?" I said, making a joke.
"Nah, you keep those, so you can strangle yourself if it turns out you need to."
"Why would I need to?"
"I really couldn't say," Vince shrugged. "But these guys working here, let me tell you, they're all fucking crazy. They're making these teeny-weeny little things you can't see, pushing around molecules and shit, sticking them together. It's real tense and detailed work, and it makes them crazy, every fucking one of them. Nutty as loons. Come this way."
We passed through another set of glass doors, but this time there was no spray. We entered the power plant. Beneath blue halogen lamps, I saw huge metal tubs 10 feet high and fat ceramic insulators thick as a man's leg. Everything hummed. I felt a distinct vibration in the floor. There were signs all around with jagged red lightning bolts saying, "Warning, lethal electrical currents."
"You use a lot of power here," I said. "Enough for a small town," Vince said. He pointed to one of the signs. "Take those warnings seriously. We had problems with fires a while back."
"Oh?"
"Yeah, got a nest of rats in the building. Buggers kept getting fried, literally. I hate the smell of burning rat fur, don't you?"
"Never had that experience," I said.
"Smells like what you'd think."
"Uh-huh," I said. "How did the rats get in?"
"Up through the toilet bowl."
I must have looked surprised because Vince said,
"Oh, you don't know that? Rats do that all the time. It's just a short swim for them to get in. Of course, if it happened while you were sitting, it'd be a nasty surprise."
He gave a short laugh.
"Problem was, the contractor for the building didn't bury the leach field deep enough. Anyhow, rats got in. We've had a few accidents like that since I've been here."
"Is that right? What kind of accidents?" He shrugged.
"They tried to make these buildings perfect," he said, "because they're working with such small size things. But it's not a perfect world, Jack. Never has been. Never will be."
I said again, "What kind of accidents?" By then, we had come to the far door with a keypad, and Vince punched in numbers quickly. The door clicked open.
"All the doors are keyed the same, 06, 04, 02.
Vince pushed the door wide, and we stepped into a covered passageway connecting the power plant to the other buildings. It was stifling hot here, despite the roar of the air conditioner.
"Contractor," Vince explained. "Never balanced the air handlers right. We had them back 5 times to fix it, but this passage is always hot."
At the end of the corridor was another door, and Vince had me punch in the code myself. The door clicked open. I faced another airlock, a wall of thick glass with another wall a few feet beyond. And behind that second wall, I saw Ricky Morse, in jeans and a T-shirt, grinning and waving cheerfully to me. His T-shirt said, "Obey me, I am Root." It was an inside joke. In the Unix operating system, it meant the boss. Over an intercom speaker, Ricky said,
"I'll take it from here, Vince."
Vince waved.
"No problem."
"You fixed that positive pressure setting?"
"Did it an hour ago. Why?"
"It may not be holding in the main lab."
"I'll check it again," Vince said. "Maybe we got another leak somewhere."
He slapped me on the back, jerked his thumb toward the interior of the building.
"Lots of luck in there."
Then he turned and walked back the way he came.
"It's great to see you," Ricky said.
"You know the code to get in?"
I said I did. He pointed to a keypad. I punched the numbers in. The glass wall slid sideways. I stepped into another narrow space about 4 feet wide, with metal grills on all 4 sides.
A wall closed behind me. A fierce blast of air shot up from the floor, puffing up my trouser legs, ruffling my clothing. Almost immediately, it was followed by blasts of air coming from both sides, then from top, blowing down hard on my hair and shoulders. Then a whoosh, a vacuum. The glass in front of me slid laterally. I smoothed down my hair and stepped out.
"Sorry about that." Ricky shook my hand vigorously. "But at least we don't have to wear bunny suits," he said.
I noticed that he looked strong, healthy. The muscles in his forearms were defined. I said, "You look good, Ricky. Working out?"
"Oh, you know, not really."
"You're pretty cut," I said. I punched him on the shoulder. He grinned.
"Just tension on the job. Did Vince frighten you?"
"Not exactly."
"He's a little strange," Ricky said.
Vince grew up alone out in the desert with his mother. She died when he was 5. Body was pretty decomposed when they finally found her. Poor kid, he just didn't know what to do. I guess I'd be strange, too. Ricky gave a shrug.
"But I'm glad you're here, Jack. I was afraid you wouldn't come."
Despite Ricky's apparent good health, I was noticing now that he seemed nervous, edgy. He led me briskly down a short hallway.
"So, how's Julia?"
"Broke her arm and hit her head pretty badly. She's in the hospital for observation, but she's going to be all right."
"Good, that's good."
He nodded quickly, continuing down the corridor.
"Who's taking care of the kids?"
I told him that my sister was in town.
"Then you can stay a while, a few days?"
I said. "I guess, if you need me that long." Ordinarily, software consultants don't spend a lot of time on site. One day, maybe two, not more than that. Ricky glanced over his shoulder at me.
"Did Julia, explain to you about this place?"
"Not really, no."
"But you knew she was spending a lot of time here?"
I said. "Oh, sure, yes.
The last few weeks she came out almost every day on the helicopter, stayed over a couple of nights, too."
I said, "I didn't know she took such an interest in manufacturing." Ricky seemed to hesitate a moment. Then he said,
"Well, Jack, this is a whole new thing."
He frowned.
"She really didn't tell you anything?"
"No, not really. Why?" He didn't answer. He opened the far door and waved me through.
"This is our residential module, where everybody sleeps and eats."
The air was cool after the passageway. The walls were the same smooth formica material. I heard a low, continuous whoosh of air handlers. A series of doors opened off the hallway. One of them had my name on it, written in marker on a piece of tape. Ricky opened the door.
"Home sweet home, Jack."
The room was monastic. A small bed, a tiny desk just large enough to hold a workstation, monitor, and keyboard. Above the bed, a shelf for books and clothes. All the furniture had been coated with smooth-flowing white plastic laminate. There were no nooks or crannies to hold stray particles of dirt. There was no window in the room either, but a liquid crystal screen showed a view of the desert outside. There was a plastic watch and a belt with a plastic buckle on the bed. I put them on. Ricky said,
"Dump your gear, and I'll give you the tour."
Still keeping his brisk pace, he led me into a medium-sized lounge with a couch and chairs around a coffee table and a bulletin board on the wall. All the furniture here was the same flowing plastic laminate.
"To the right is the kitchen and the rec room with TV, video games, so forth."
We entered the small kitchen. There were two people there, a man and a woman, eating sandwiches standing up.
"I think you know these guys,"
Ricky said, grinning. And I did. They had been on my team at Mediatronics. Rosie Castro was dark, thin,
exotic-looking, and sarcastic. She wore baggy cargo shorts and a T-shirt tight across her large breasts, which read, "You Wish." Independent and rebellious, Rosie had been a Shakespearean scholar at Harvard before she decided, in her words, that Shakespeare is fucking dead for fucking centuries. There is nothing new to say. What's the point? She transferred to MIT, became a protege of Robert Kim, working on natural language programming. It turned out she was brilliant at it. And these days, natural language programs were starting to involve distributed processing, because it turned out people evaluate a sentence in several ways simultaneously while it is being spoken. They don't wait until it is finished, but rather they form expectations of what is coming. That's a perfect situation for distributed processing, which can work on a problem at several points simultaneously. I said, "Still wearing those T-shirts, Rosie." At Mediatronics, we'd had some trouble about the way she dressed. "Hey, keeps the boys awake," she said, shrugging. "Actually, we ignore them." I turned to David Brooks, stiff, formal, obsessively neat, and almost bald at 28. He blinked behind thick glasses. "They're not that good, anyway," he said. Rosie stuck her tongue out at him. David was an engineer, and he had an engineer's bluntness and lack of social skills. He was also full of contradictions. Although he fussed over every detail of his work and appearance, on weekends he raced a dirt bike, often coming back covered in mud. He shook my hand enthusiastically. "I'm very glad you're here, Jack," I said. "Somebody's going to have to tell me why you're all so glad to see me." Rosie said, "Well, it's because you know more about the multi-agent algorithms that..." "I'm going to show them around first," Ricky said, interrupting. "Then we'll talk." "Why?" Rosie said. "You want it to be a surprise?"
"Hell of a surprise," David said.
"No, not at all," Ricky said, giving him a hard look. "I just want Jack to have some background first. I want to go over that with him." David looked at his watch.
"Well, how much time do you think that will take? Because I figure we've got..."
I said, "Let me show him around, for Christ's sake." Ricky was almost snarling. I was surprised. I'd never seen him lose his temper before. But apparently they had.
"Okay, okay, Ricky."
"Hey, you're the boss, Ricky."
"That's right, I am," Ricky said, still visibly angry.
"And, by the way, your break ended 10 minutes ago, so let's get back to work."
He looked into the adjoining game room.
"Where are the others?"
"Fixing the perimeter sensors."
"You mean they're outside?"
"No, no, they're in the utility room. Bobby thinks there's a calibration problem with the sensor units."
"Great. Did anybody tell Vince?"
"No, it's software. Bobby's taking care of it."
It was at that point that my cell phone beeped. I was surprised, pulled it out of my pocket. I turned to the others.
"Cell phones work?"
"Yeah," Ricky said. "We're wired here." He went back to his argument with David and Rosie.
I stepped into the corridor and got my messages. There was only one from the hospital about Julia. "We understand you are Ms. Foreman's husband, and if you could call us, please, as soon as possible." Then an extension for a Dr. Rana. I dialed back at once. The switchboard put me through. "ICU." I asked for Dr. Rana and waited until he came on. I said, "This is Jack Foreman, Julia Foreman's husband."
"Oh, yes, Mr. Foreman," a pleasant, melodic voice. "Thank you for calling back. I understand you accompanied your wife to the hospital last night, yes? Well, then, you know the seriousness of her injuries, or should I say her potential injuries. We really do feel she needs to have a thorough workup for cervical fracture and for subdural hematoma, and she needs a pelvic fracture workup as well."
"Yes," I said. "That's what I was told last night. Is there a problem?"
"Actually, there is. Your wife is refusing treatment."
She is?
Last night she allowed us to take x-rays and to set the fractures in her wrist. We've explained to her that x-rays are limited in what we can see, and that it is quite important for her to have an MRI, but she is refusing that.
I said, why?
She says she doesn't need it.
Of course she needs it, I said.
Yes, she does, Mr. Foreman,
Rana said.
I don't want to alarm you, but the concern with pelvic fracture is massive hemorrhaging into the abdomen, and, well, bleeding to death. It can happen very quickly, and...
What do you want me to do?
We'd like you to talk to her.
Of course, put her on.
Unfortunately, she's gone for some additional x-rays just now. Is there a number where you can be reached? Your cell phone? All right. One other thing. Mr. Foreman, we weren't able to take a psychiatric history from your wife.
Why is that?
She refuses to talk about it. I'm referring to drugs, any history of behavioral disorders, that kind of thing. Can you shed any light in that area?
I'll try.
I don't want to alarm you, but your wife has been, well, a bit on the irrational side, at times almost delusional.
She's been under a lot of stress lately, I said.
Yes, I am sure that contributes,
Dr. Rana said smoothly.
And she has suffered a severe head injury, which we need to investigate further. I don't want to alarm you, but frankly, it was the opinion of the psychiatric consult that your wife was suffering from a bipolar disorder, or a drug disorder, or both.
I see.
And, of course, such questions naturally arise in the context of a single-car automobile accident.
He meant that the accident might be a suicide attempt. I didn't think that was likely. I have no knowledge of my wife taking drugs, I said. But I have been concerned about her behavior for, oh, a few weeks now. Ricky came over and stood by me impatiently. I put my hand over the phone. It's about Julia. He nodded and glanced at his watch, raised his eyebrows. I thought it was pretty odd that he would push me when I was talking to the hospital about my wife and his immediate superior. The doctor rambled on for a while, and I did my best to answer his questions. But the fact was, I didn't have any information that could help him. He said he would have Julia call when she got back, and I said I would wait for the call. I flipped the phone closed. Ricky said,
okay, fine. Sorry to rush you, Jack, but, you know, I've got a lot to show you.
Is there a time problem? I said.
I don't know, maybe.
I started to ask what he meant by that, but he was already leading me forward, walking quickly. We left the residential area, passing through another glass door and down another passageway. This passage, I noticed, was tightly sealed. We walked along a glass walkway suspended above the floor. The glass had little perforations, and beneath was a series of vacuum ducts for suction. By now, I was growing accustomed to the constant hiss of the air handlers. Midway down the corridor was another pair of glass doors. We had to go through them one at a time. They parted as we went through and closed behind us. Continuing on, I again had the distinct feeling of being in a prison, of going through a succession of barred gates, going deeper and deeper into something. It might be all high-tech and shiny glass walls, but it was still a prison.
Day 6, 8:12 a.m. We came into a large room marked Utility, and beneath it, Mole Stock, Fab Stock, Feed Stock. The walls and ceiling were covered with the familiar smooth plastic laminate. Large laminated containers were stacked on the floor. Off to the right, I saw a row of big stainless steel kettles sunk below ground with lots of piping and valves surrounding them and coming up to the first floor level. It looked exactly like a microbrewery, and I was about to ask Ricky about it when he said, "So there you are." Working at a junction box beneath a monitor screen were three more members of my old team. They looked slightly guilty as we came up, like kids caught with their hands in the cookie jar. Of course, Bobby Lembeck was their leader. At 35, Bobby now supervised more code than he wrote, but he could still write when he wanted to. As always, he was wearing faded jeans and a Ghost in the Shell t-shirt, his ubiquitous Walkman clamped to his waist. Then there was May Chang, beautiful and delicate, about as different from Rosie Castro as any woman could be. May had worked as a field biologist in Sichuan, studying the golden snub-nosed monkey, before turning to programming in her mid-twenties. Her time in the field, as well as her natural inclination, led her to be almost silent. May said very little, moved almost soundlessly, and never raised her voice, but she never lost an argument either. Like many field biologists, she had developed the uncanny ability to slip into the background, to become unnoticed, almost to vanish. And finally, Charlie Davenport, grumpy, rumpled, and already overweight at 30. Slow and lumbering, he looked as if he had slept in his clothes, and in fact he often did after a marathon programming session. Charlie had worked under John Holland in Chicago and Doyne Farmer at Los Alamos. He was an expert in genetic algorithms, the kind of programming that mimicked natural selection to hone answers. But he was an irritating personality. He hummed, he snorted, talked to himself, and farted with noisy abandon. The group only tolerated him because he was so talented.
"Does it really take three people to do this?" Ricky said after I'd shaken hands all around.
"Yes," Bobby said. "It does take three people, El Ruto, because it's complicated."
"Why? And don't call me El Ruto."
"I obey, Mr. Root."
"Just get on with it."
"Well," Bobby said, "I started to check the sensors after this morning's episode, and it looks to me like they're miscalibrated. But since nobody is going outside, the question is whether we're reading them wrong or whether the sensors themselves are faulty, or just scaled wrong on the equipment in here. May knows these sensors. She's used them in China. I'm making code revisions now, and Charlie is here because he won't go away and leave us alone."
"Shit. I have better things to do," Charlie said. "But I wrote the algorithm that controls the sensors, and we need to optimize the sensor code after they're done. I'm just waiting until they stop screwing around. Then I'll optimize."
He looked pointedly at Bobby.
"None of these guys can optimize worth a damn."
May said,
"Bobby can."
"Yeah, if you give him 6 months, maybe."
"Children, children," Ricky said. "Let's not make a scene in front of our guest." I smiled blandly. The truth was, I hadn't been paying attention to what they were saying. I was just watching them. These were three of my best programmers, and when they had worked for me, they had been self-assured to the point of arrogance. But now I was struck by how nervous the group was. They were all on edge, bickering, jumpy. And thinking back, I realized that Rosie and David had been on edge, too. Charlie started humming in that irritating way of his.
"Oh, Christ," Bobby Lembeck said. "Would you tell him to shut up?"
Ricky said.
"Charlie, you know we've talked about the humming."
Charlie continued to hum.
"Charlie?"
Charlie gave a long, theatrical sigh. He stopped humming.
"Thank you," Bobby said.
Charlie rolled his eyes and looked at the ceiling.
"All right," Ricky said. "Finish up quickly and get back to your stations."
"Okay, fine.
I want everybody in place as soon as possible."
"Okay,"
Bobby said.
"I'm serious. In your places."
"For Christ's sake, Ricky.
Okay, okay. Now will you stop talking and let us work?"
Leaving the group behind, Ricky took me across the floor to a small room. I said, "Ricky, these kids aren't the way they were when they worked for me."
"I know. Everybody's a little uptight right now."
"And why is that?"
"Because of what's going on here."
"And what is going on here?" He stopped before a small cubicle on the other side of the room.
"Julia couldn't tell you because it was classified."
He touched the door with a key card. I said, "Classified? Medical imaging is classified?" The door latch clicked open and we went inside. The door closed behind us. I saw a table, two chairs, a computer monitor, and a keyboard. Ricky sat down and immediately started typing.
"The medical imaging project was just an afterthought," he said. "A minor commercial application of the technology we are already developing."
"Uh-huh. Which is?"
"Military."
"Zymos is doing military work?"
"Yes, under contract."
He paused.
2 years ago, the Department of Defense realized from their experience in Bosnia that there was enormous value to robot aircraft that could fly overhead and transmit battlefield images in real time. The Pentagon knew that there would be more and more sophisticated uses for these flying cameras in future wars. You could use them to spot the locations of enemy troops, even when they were hidden in jungle or in buildings. You could use them to control laser-guided rocket fire, or to identify the location of friendly troops, and so on. But commanders on the ground could call up the images they wanted, in the spectra they wanted, visible, infrared, UV, whatever. Real-time imaging was going to be a very powerful tool in future warfare.
"Okay."
"But obviously," Ricky said, "these robot cameras were vulnerable. You could shoot them down like pigeons. The Pentagon wanted a camera that couldn't be shot down. They imagined something very small, maybe the size of a dragonfly, a target too small to hit. But there were problems with power supply, with small control surfaces, and with resolution using such a small lens. They needed a bigger lens."
I nodded. "And so you thought of a swarm of nano components?"
"That's right."
Ricky pointed to the screen, where a cluster of black spots wheeled and turned in the air like birds.
"A cloud of components would allow you to make a camera with as large a lens as you wanted. And it couldn't be shot down because a bullet would just pass through the cloud. Furthermore, you could disperse the cloud the way a flock of birds disperses with a gunshot. Then the camera would be invisible until it reformed again. So it seemed an ideal solution. The Pentagon gave us 3 years of DARPA funding."
"And?"
"We set out to make the camera. It was, of course, immediately obvious that we had a problem with distributed intelligence.